Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look amazing. What have you been doing?
You've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, if you qualify, Zelday providers can prescribe semaglutide, the same active ingredient, at up to 90% less without insurance. Done all online.
No wait at the doctor's office or pharmacy?
No wait. Zelday can ship the same active ingredients as other expensive GLP-1s to your door.
Get started with Zelday today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less. That's #250 keyword care.
He lost and he went home peacefully. So like that is the big takeaway of Adams. He was the first president to lose and he went home peacefully.
Hey folks, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Oh my gosh, Labor Day has come and gone. The summer is winding down, but hey, the fall is going to be exciting as hell. And wanted to have a great conversation. My guest today is Dr. Lindsay Chervinsky. She's a presidential historian and executive director of the George Washington Presidential Library at the Mount Vernon. Previously, she was a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, a historian at the White House Historical Association, and a fellow at the Kluge Center at the Library of Congress. She is the author of the book we're going to get into. It's a new one out now, Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Precedents That Forged the Republic. I did a wonderful program with her through the Institute of Politics, Policy, Politics, and History with the University of District of Columbia. She and I connected and had a lot of fun. Great conversation. I'm looking forward to this conversation with her on her new book, John Adams. There are a lot of dots, folks, that we connect. So you want to stay tuned for all of that right here on the Michael Steele podcast right after this. Hey, folks, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Always good to see you. Well, the summer is done. We're into the fall. We're ready for more fun, right? Okay, guess not. Y'all know what happens when it comes September. Things kind of slow down. Kids are back in school. People tune in and want to hear intelligent stuff, right? Well, that's why we have the professor with us. Lindsay Chervinsky, how are you doing? Welcome to the podcast.
I am doing well. Thank you so much for having me. It's so fun to be here with you.
Oh, it's the same. It's good to see you again. We had some fun. Back, I guess, what was it? Is it been a year? No, it hasn't been. Can't be.
I think it has.
Wow. Yeah, because you were just then talking about, you were writing the book.
Yeah.
And making the presidency, John Adams and the Precedents, back then. So yeah, and it's done and it's coming out and you're excited, right?
Super pumped. So excited. I mean, as you know, these things take a really long time and you work on them for years and then you finish it and then you just have to sit and wait while it's published. And so it's so fun to actually finally have the printed thing in your hands and out in the world.
Well, so the book, folks, just for everybody to get, because you know I'm going to want you to pick up a copy of it and read it and contextualize it for yourselves so you can better understand both history and present and how that kind of forms the future. The book is Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Precedents That Forged the Republic. Get it on Amazon and other book locations. But the key thing for me, I guess, Lindsay, is why John Adams? He was a cantankerous kind of sort, my understanding of his personage, and he had some real interesting challenges. Certainly, the political battles with the likes of Thomas Jefferson and some of the other founding fathers, and possibly mothers. What say you about one John Adams?
Well, first, in John Adams' defense, he was a little bit of he was a little bit of a curmudgeon, but he was a lovable curmudgeon, and we all know some of those, and so we have to keep space for them. I do think that he has received a particularly bad rap because he had the great misfortune to be living at a time with two of the all-time greatest propagandists in American history, which were Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. And doesn't mean that they weren't brilliant, but they were totally brilliant propagandists. And
so, sidebar that real quick. So we contextualize what you're about to say about Adams in light of, because that's the first time I've heard someone refer to both Jefferson and Hamilton as propagandists. So we're going to do a quick sidebar because we're going to come back into that with Adams.
Yeah.
But this, I really want to, folks, to, I want to understand what you're saying here.
So I said that in a theater, and someone in the audience was like, oh. They couldn't believe that I would call, So, most people think of Hamilton with the Federalist Papers, which, again, Federalist Papers are brilliant, but the Federalist Papers were written to achieve an aim. They were written to persuade a certain group of people to ratify the Constitution. They were not analytical assessments of an existing document. They were a persuasive document. Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, in 1800 especially, were competing against John Adams for partisan aims, and they were writing about John Adams as a political opponent. And yet most of their writings that they wrote in the heat of partisan battles, historians over the generations have taken verbatim as analytical assessments of who John Adams is or was. Mm-hmm. And certainly there was often, a grain of truth in those, but for all of their other work, for all of the other things they have written, historians tend to take it with a grain of salt. They tend to contextualize what did Adams say, what does Jefferson say vis-a-vis Hamilton, and kind of trying to find somewhere in the middle. And yet when it comes to John Adams, they tend not to do that. And they just kind of accept the very worst that Jefferson and Hamilton had to say. And the problem is they were really good at saying really bad things.
Right.
And so, I think certainly Adams had his flaws, and the book contains a lot of them, but he wasn't ever as extreme or as extremely ridiculous as they made him out to be.
So Adams, when I did a fellowship at Brown University about our political, contextualizing our political experience here in the country and trying to help people understand that a lot of the underbelly of politics today is very similar, if not the same as, but certainly not. I mean, that they were pretty ugly back in the day going at each
horrible.
Other. I mean, I when you were talking just now, I was thinking about one of the things I would share with students is in that presidential race of 1800 between Jefferson and Adams. Adams oftentimes, they had the folks who supported him, and I think it was a Boston newspaper on behalf of Adams said, if you vote for Thomas Jefferson, your daughters and your mothers will become prostitutes. I mean, it was that level of, I was like, really? I mean, so you could see though, I mean, Adams and his team gave as good as they got. But I take your point that because he was not the most lovable guy in the first meeting, a lot of that tended to stick with him. So he had to sling back pretty hard himself at times.
He did. And, I think also the way that our political system has developed over centuries, Adams never became the person that was associated with the Federalist Party. That was Hamilton. And then the Federalist Party disappeared, whereas Jefferson's party reigned supreme and was, what became eventually the Democratic Party. And that has obviously morphed and evolved in a lot of different ways. But so there was never a constituency that was championing Adams's legacy. There was never a constituency that was saying his memory was really great, and he was kind of a man without a party. So the combination of all those factors, I think, has led us to remember him, combined with the fact that he was sandwiched between Washington and Jefferson, which is not really fair to anybody. has combined to for us to remember him as something less than he was. And so, first of all, that I thought was interesting as a why Adams question. But perhaps more importantly, my first book was on the creation of the president's cabinet in Washington's administration. But then Washington left, and we have never had a president like that because we've never respected or revered a president in the way that people revered Washington when he was in office. There's never been anybody who has governed with such unquestioned authority.
Mm-hmm.
So how did the presidency work for everyone else? How was it going to work for everyone else? And that was Adams' task, was figuring out what powers he could use, how the institution would function. And that's a much messier question, but was a really interesting one to me.
Because, you know, just so folks remember, and I don't want to mistake, so you, I know you will correct me, Adams was our second president. And therefore, to your point about being sandwiched between him, between Washington and the third president, who would be Jefferson, there were a lot of different political dynamics at play. One was the just as you noted, the revered elevation of Washington to the point that many of the people at the time wanted Washington to be an imperial president. Say, you can have it for as long as you want it. Mm-hmm. It's yours, baby. Do what you want with it. And mm-hmm. Washington's like, you know what? I'm just going to go back to Virginia and plow the land. And he did. So then you have someone like Adams coming into space, wanting to succeed President Washington. Tell us a little bit about Adams. Who was Adams? Who was John Adams? What kind of person was he? Yeah, he was cantankerous. Why? How did that play itself out? And clearly there was something about him that the colonists now, the United States, the American people, made him president to the point where they said, okay, you get to follow George Washington, not Thomas Jefferson.
So John Adams was a multi-generation New Englander. He came from good Puritan stock. You probably couldn't have two white dudes who were more different in terms of personality in the 1790s than Washington and Adams in terms of who they were and where they came from. Adams came from a modest family. He wasn't poor per se, but they had to work and they had to work hard. He went to Harvard when he was a young teenager and then was a teacher and then a lawyer. He first gained some acclaim for his defense of the Boston soldiers after mm-hmm. the Boston Massacre. It was the first instance where he did something that he knew was going to be unpopular because he believed it was right and it was important based on principle. And he kind of liked those moments when he could be obstinate on behalf of some, you know, higher cause. He then was sent to the Continental Congress as a Massachusetts representative and was one of the early and most strident voices for independence and was quite essential in engineering the steps towards it. He engineered Washington's nomination as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. He engineered Jefferson's authoring of the Declaration. And then he was sent on a series of diplomatic posts to France, the Netherlands, and London. In between, in a little break in between those, he also authored the Massachusetts State Constitution, which ended up serving as a model for the U.S. Constitution and is the longest written constitution in the world in terms of surviving, the longest lasting. And then when he came back from his position in London and they were holding these first elections, there was a sense that there needed to be geographic balance. So everyone knew that Washington was going to be the first president. There was no question. He was the only person with a national stature other than maybe Benjamin Franklin, but he was really, really, really old and actually died in Washington's first year in office. So everyone knew Washington was going to be it. And so if you have a Virginian, you needed a Northerner of some stature. And the options were maybe John Jay, maybe John Adams, maybe someone from New York. But John Adams was kind of the name that was known to most. And so he received the second most number of votes, which was how the vice president was selected at the time. But it was really a matter of like length of service, clear dedication to the cause, clear patriotism, right, and commitment to independence, and a recognition for his many decades of service.
So he becomes the vice president by virtue of getting the second most votes.
He does.
So what did that relationship between Washington and Adams look like, particularly given the fact that Washington was unwilling to really support Adams and give him the kind of guidance that, you would think he would give him to be successful in the job and to, quite honestly, be a possible successor. I mean, it would have mitigated a lot of the noise if Washington had put his imprimatur on Adams the way the nation had put its imprimatur on Washington.
Yes, it would have. So at the time, the vice president basically has one sentence in the Constitution. And Adams described it as the most, I think, worthless job ever created by humankind.
This is about the
which,
number two spot. Look, I was a number two. I made you make the most of the number two. You drive around with you in your carriage, your buggy with your Bible, and just in case you get a, someone comes up and stops the carriage and say, "Hey, it's your turn." That's how it works.
Yeah. So he really didn't like being bored, and there wasn't much for him to do. But there was genuinely a question of, like, what is the vice president supposed to do?
Right.
And the expectation at the time was that the vice president would sit in on the Senate sessions. And so Adams did. He sat in on the Senate session every day it was in session. Initially, the first year, he really tried to guide their debates until they made it clear that they would like him to keep his mouth shut. And so then
Okay, you see that big chair? We just want you to sit there. You ain't got nothing
just
to
sit
say. Just sit
quietly,
there. Be
sit and
quiet.
look pretty. Sit and look pretty. So for the next 7 years, he sat there, and it was just, you can imagine how miserable he was. There was some thought initially, perhaps, that he would have been more of an advisor to Washington because he was a man of experience and of the world. But pretty early on, Washington had asked him for his advice on some things. But then Adams had taken a position on what the president should be called that was fairly unpopular. He wanted a more ostentatious title because he thought it would lend respect to the new office. And it caused Washington, I think, to distrust his judgment. Now, Washington didn't write down his feelings, so we're trying to sort of surmise based on actions. But I think it caused him to distrust Adams' political judgment. And so from that point on, he really distanced himself from Adams. He never invited him to a cabinet meeting. He really treated Adams as sort of a separate entity, even though they did socialize multiple times a week because there was this small elite social circle and there were these official events and Adams attended them. I don't necessarily begrudge him for not including him in the cabinet meetings because, again, they're doing this for the first time. They're doing this from scratch. They're kind of trying to figure it out. Where I do begrudge Washington was once he announced he was retiring and it became clear that Adams was going to win. So Washington did not make any sort of pronouncement about who he preferred, but Adams did win the election in 1796. Washington didn't tell him anything about the presidency. He didn't tell him that the secretaries that Washington currently had in office were not great. They were actually pretty flawed. And that is where I think that he fell short. And that sort of information sharing we have seen time and time again over the centuries is really quite important.
So what is so I'm glad you raised that point. So what did Adams's cabinet look like? I mean, what and how did it impact his presidency because he did not know and was not told, even though he was Washington's vice president. You would presume he sat in the meetings. He could see these people weren't like the cream of the, cream of the crop here. I mean, but
Well, not only did he see it, he wrote about it. He wrote about how James McHenry, who was the Secretary of War, was terrible. And Timothy Pickering was smarter, but he was not dispositionally well suited to be Secretary of State. The problem was that the cabinet positions were not as prestigious as they are today. And so John Adams, not knowing any of this information, not knowing that they were terrible, and thinking if they were terrible, then Washington would have gotten rid of them or would say something, he thought, okay, well, they must not be terrible. Also, he knew how difficult it was for Washington to find replacements because, of course, Washington's first cabinet had the luminaries of Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. And when they retired, it became very difficult to find good replacements because the job didn't have a lot of pay. You were away from home for months and months at a time. You opened yourself up to criticism. It was a lot of hard work. And so Adams knew, well, if Washington is having trouble filling these positions, then I'm going to have trouble. He also worried that if he removed them, it might be seen as criticism of Washington's choices, and that he certainly didn't want to do. And lastly, he worried that the American people were very stressed about this transition. We tend to forget about it because we know, you know, what happened next, and we take the transition of 1800 much more seriously. But the American people, this was the first time they had experienced a presidential transition, and it was very scary. And so Adams thought keeping those secretaries would provide some continuity, would provide some institutional stability. And so he kept all of the secretaries that Washington had had in his cabinet. And the Attorney General Charles Lee was actually pretty good. He was independent minded and he was pretty loyal to the office. The Secretary of Treasury Oliver Wolcott Jr. was competent, although he was very much loyal to forces outside of the administration. And then the other two, Timothy Pickering, who was the Secretary of State, was better suited for the Spanish Inquisition than diplomacy. And James McHenry was the Secretary of War and was a very nice man, but very incapable of managing the details required of the War Department.
It's fascinating to watch. I mean, and I think it's important for folks to kind of give some context to all of what you've just said. Think about it. This is the first presidential election in 1800. And you've got the
1796.
Yes, because you got Washington. Yeah, you got Washington in 1796. But the first real battle for the presidency was Adams and Jefferson after Washington. That's really where I wanted to go, and that battle was really kind of part of the question of, how do you do a transition? Should I keep cabinet members? Do I really stake out my own space? And that clearly was something Jefferson wanted to do. I mean, Jefferson, you look at his presidency and he's like, okay, little playboy, I see what you're doing. I see you. Adams, though, seemed to be stuck. And this is why you make the initial point of Adams being caught between these two presidencies. He was stuck between honoring the very short-lived tradition of Washington. Right? I mean, you're only talking, you know,
8 years.
Eight years. That's it. Right. And sort of looking at the country and moving forward, and how do you, if we're not going to do this imperial presidency thing, what does that mean? How did this presidential vice presidential relationship or dynamic between Adams and Jefferson look similar or different to the one of Washington and Adams?
It's a great point. Well, I think, you know, just to close out the part of, you know, trying something new, Jefferson, when he was elected in 1800 and then inaugurated in 1801, he was really freed from trying to follow Washington's example, because Adams had come in between and had a rough time from sometimes. And also he was from a different party. So he was given a lot more flexibility to kind of throw it out and start from scratch. Although he didn't really start from scratch. He kept what he wanted to. In terms of the president vice president dynamic, in some ways it was quite similar. Jefferson didn't attend any cabinet meetings and wasn't involved in decisions and, you know, didn't have any sort of formal responsibility other than being present when the Senate was in session. On the other hand, ideologically, it felt quite different, because even though Washington and Adams weren't working together, they were nominally of the same coalition, and Adams was very loyal to Washington. Had they ever really sat down and talked about it, they had incredibly overlapping, especially foreign policy ideas. Like, they really were on the same page. Whereas Jefferson, when he was vice president, he literally met with the French minister to the United States and encouraged France not to sign a peace treaty with the United States and to continue to seize American ships and imprison American sailors and steal American goods, because if he won the election 4 years later, he would give them a better deal while vice president.
God, that sounds like grossly familiar.
It's ridiculous.
Don't solve that problem on the border. Just leave it for me to deal with it when I become president. That is
exactly.
Put a pin in that one, folks, because that's an arc I didn't even think existed in terms of how
and not just as a candidate, but as a vice president.
But that's what I'm saying. As a sitting vice president
yeah.
of the United States, Jefferson is like, no, dude, we're not going to don't do it. Just keep doing what you're doing. Keep stealing our goods and imprisoning our sailors. When I become president, I'll give you a better deal.
Yeah, wow. It's, I mean, had France actually declared war on the United States, that would have been treason. But because there wasn't declared war, it wasn't treason. So it just,
people knew
that dynamic has
Adams
not really.
Knew that was what Adams knew that that was Jefferson, what Jefferson was doing?
No, I mean, so Adams knew that Jefferson was up to some machinations. He knew he was kind of writing garbage behind his back. He knew that maybe he was
kind of.
And
this is his vice president.
He knew that maybe he was sort of like encouraging opposition and newspaper editors and maybe some like civic groups or even local militias, but he did not know that he was meeting with the French minister.
Wow. Okay. All right. We're gonna take a moment and so I can collect myself. Because Jefferson, man, you're just a son of a. Anyway, I told you this was going to be a good conversation, folks. I told you this. I'm really excited about having Lindsay on to talk about her great new work, Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Precedents That Forged the Republic. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to connect that big dot that she just laid out there with the big dots that are now taking shape in our 21st century presidential race. More with Dr. Lindsay Chervinsky, presidential historian, right after this. Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. Well, I hope y'all have been sort of settling into this great historic lesson about our presidents, Adams and Jefferson, Washington, and how these individuals interacted in such a way that really kind of shapes and has shaped our presidential politics, if you will, today. You talk about John Adams and the precedents that forged the Republic. What are some of those precedents that tie themselves to Adams?
There are three big ones. So the first was he showed up. He knew, as we talked about, that it was going to be really quite terrible. And he demonstrated that someone else could be in this office, which sounds kind of like an obvious duh statement to us, but was really genuinely something they were not sure about. And one of my favorite examples to demonstrate that uncertainty is the portrait that was painted of Adams in his first year of his presidency by William Winstanley. Highly recommend everyone Google it. It is terrible. It is awful. And it's terrible and awful because they basically copied and pasted Adams' head onto Washington because they could not figure out how to visualize what a president looked like other than Washington. And so it's ridiculous because the head doesn't match the body.
So they copied and pasted his head on top
it's
of
so
Washington's
bad.
Body.
It's
oh
so
my
bad.
God. This is
like the sizing
I'm having,
is all wrong.
I'm
it's
having
terrible.
AI.
It's so bad. So
this is their 18th century version of AI, right?
Yes.
Oh my God.
So, and it does actually kind of look, yeah, it does look like it. It's really bad. So, but that's really important because there was a real question about whether or not this office would work for anybody else. And he proved that it could. And one of the ways that he proved that it could was the second big piece, which was that he was very protective of executive power, not necessarily his own power, executive power. And he defended the president's right to establish foreign policy, to conduct diplomacy. He ensured that the cabinet did not have a power-sharing arrangement as part of that. There was an attempt to make the executive branch more like the cabinet in the British style, where it's like a power-sharing arrangement, mm-hmm. and he pushed back on that. He also was the first president to fire a secretary, and that power was very theoretical. It was not really written down. Congress had really tiptoed around it in its legislation. And when he fired Timothy Pickering, finally, and Congress didn't say anything and in fact confirmed his replacement, it gave tacit endorsement to the fact that the president does in fact have complete control over the over the presidency and its personnel in the executive branch. And the Supreme Court affirmed that in 1924, but that's a very essential part to the character of the presidency. And then the third one is the peaceful transfer of power.
That was the Marbury case?
No. So in 1924, Wilson sued to have the right to remove a postmaster general, and the Supreme Court said that he had the right to do so. Until that point, it had sort of been an unwritten rule, with the exception of Andrew Johnson and the Tenure of Office Act, okay, when he was trying, yep, to kind of – that's what led to his impeachment. So other than Andrew Johnson, most presidents enjoyed that right. But Adams was the first to do it because Washington had never fired anyone. And until you actually test that power, it's very fuzzy and amorphous and sort of, you know, cloud-like. So that was a really big moment. And then the last one is the peaceful transfer of power. And the peaceful transfer of power takes two to tango. It really requires both participants on both sides being committed to it. And Adams was the common denominator in the first two, 1787 and 1801. And in 1801 was quite instrumental in ensuring, first, that it happened, and second, that it happened in a productive way. He worked really hard with his cabinet to ensure that Jefferson had everything he needed. And that set the tone for what a transition should look like.
You note that in the epilogue, as a matter of fact, I want to read very quickly from you. You say this peaceful transfer of power was not the result of a clearly articulated process in the Constitution or a specific statute. In 1800, very few details of the transition process had been written down or codified. While we might assume today that 18th century Americans revered the Constitution and respected the sanctity of their elections as a central feature of the Republic, they did not. Instead, this defining characteristic of American democracy emerged because the first two administrations established precedents that crystallized into norms and customs. These political practices were not guaranteed. They required repetition and practice over decades to become a cherished feature of the political system. The Constitution's quasi-sacred status emerged slowly over the centuries. None of this would have been possible without John Adams.
Yes,
that's my work. That's my research.
I stand by it.
Yeah, you stand by it. That's my point, and I'm sticking to it. No, but the point is, and I think what I took away from that was this very important line. While we might assume today that 18th century Americans revered the Constitution and respected the sanctity of their elections as a central feature of the Republic, they did not. And so as I'm looking at and contextualizing the deconstruction of those quasi-sacred status that emerged over time, the cherished features of our political system that were allowed to form because Adam was not a pain in the ass. He was not egocentric enough to say, me, 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 but really then began to understand exactly what Washington did and why Washington did what he did the way he did it. So when it was his time to transition to Jefferson, he completed that process. He completed the circle that Washington started to draw to say the presidency is not imperial. It is not infallible. It is not,
not
separate. Right, exactly. That's pretty powerful when you consider today what's happening. What happened in the transfer of power between Donald Trump and Joe Biden?
Yeah, I mean, seeing that for me is actually what really sparked the book, because I had been planning to write about John Adams, but seeing that unlocked the angle that I wanted to take, because I started to, with that frame of mind, I was asking questions about how do you start this process? And I know, and people who have read a lot of history know, that it takes a very long time to build things up, especially if they're not through force. I mean, most things in a republic actually require citizen buy-in. They are not enforced with military might. And so that takes decades and centuries of repetition in order to form the sort of force that precedents and norms we sort of attribute that force to them, but that takes a very, very long time. So I started asking questions about like, where does that start? And that was where I started to see these things about John Adams that I felt like had really been overlooked. And what John Adams understood, and what I think this generation understood, which we do not always understand, is it's really easy to tear those things down. It's really hard to build them. And it takes a long time to teach citizens to cherish them and to work to uphold them. And if you stop paying attention to it, then they become, there start to be chinks in the armor, and they become very easy to pull down.
It's interesting because you give, and I think rightly, I mean, I'm convinced by the case you make for Adams, that he in many ways played a more important role than certainly we appreciate today, but more importantly than his contemporaries appreciated at the time, in establishing democratic norms and actually saying, no, if we've got three equal branches of government, this is how it's going to work. And yeah, a president should have the authority and the power to fire cabinet members, but that's not dispositive of anything other than, hey, he wants better people in the job. You know, it wasn't, that's a very interesting development, particularly when you consider the nastiness between him and Hamilton in particular. Yeah. Hamilton hated him. Would that be largely because he looked at Adams as someone that was uncontrollable or someone who was not a conformist to groupthink?
Hamilton didn't like Adams because he couldn't control him. He said that he was too independent, which to us is like, great. Right. We would love to have an independent-minded politician. That sounds fantastic. Right. But for Hamilton, he wanted to be in charge. He thought he knew best. And Adams viewed Hamilton with scorn and with derision. And especially when it came to foreign policy, Hamilton would try and lecture Adams, and Adams would look at him and say, you haven't been to Europe. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, get out of my office.
Get on a boat. Get out of here.
Get out of here. Or worse, he would ignore him. And there is nothing that Hamilton hated more than being ignored. And so that combination, Hamilton, really loathed Adams. And they just kind of, I think, were oil and water, but also Adams understood that Hamilton, for all of his genius, could actually be quite a dangerous figure, and distrusted him.
How do you, so let's bring this forward. You wrote a piece last month and in the Bulwark, which I'm happy to have you be a part of the Bulwark platform here in this conversation on my podcast, talking about Joe Biden and the art of the presidential farewell and all of the noise that we just saw recently around President Biden stepping down, giving political power away freely, with a lot less drama than those who were trying to demand it from him. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that and contextualize it, if you can, with respect to both. I mean, obvious Washington is the sort of the standard bearer of how you do that. But Adams was, too, I think, to a certain extent, particularly given, as we were just talking, some of those norms that he was, you know, putting in place maybe without even realizing.
Yeah. So Washington, I mean, he just deserves so much credit for walking away from power twice. And this was, you know, the age of Napoleon when people didn't give up power. There's a reason it was so extraordinary and it was viewed as so extraordinary. And even though he did have sometimes personal ideas about why he wanted to leave, he was tired, he was grouchy, he wanted to go home. I'm at Mount Vernon. I can tell you today, the weather is spectacular. I understand why he didn't want to leave. But he also had much bigger ideas about the importance of that transition happening intentionally and while he was alive and in a sort of dignified fashion and not sort of haphazardly in the moment of grief. And so that was really important. And his farewell address, which I wrote a little bit about, was probably one of the most prescient political documents in American history, because he articulates these things that will pull apart Americans in the 1790s, but also pulled apart Americans in the 1850s and in the 1890s and in the 1960s and today. And so he was really seeing these trends that could come up again and again, and warning Americans to not allow their differences to blind them to all of the things that they had in common, and reminding them that together they were much stronger than they were as separate entities. Adams had a slightly less dignified transition in that he did leave early the morning of Jefferson's transition. But let me take the big picture, which is that he lost and he went home peacefully. So like, that is the big takeaway of Adams. He was the first president to lose, and he went home peacefully, and he intentionally got in a public carriage to demonstrate that he was an average citizen. He was no longer president. He was very attuned to those symbolic gestures. And, you know, Jefferson hadn't invited him to the inauguration. There was no tradition of presidents having lost or done so. That did not happen until 1845. And the election of 1800 was so contested and so near calamitous in terms of its violence that I genuinely believe that he was worried his presence would be seen as a distraction, would maybe take away from this transition moment. So I think he really did have the best intentions in mind. And so that piece that I was talking about with Joe Biden is what I was saying was, you know, here, Joe Biden, I think, had the opportunity with that speech to speak to some of these bigger themes. I actually think the very end of his speech kind of did that. I wish he had just given that portion of it. I think a shorter, snappier, more politically forward-looking would have been more beneficial. But then the second piece was, in Washington's final years, when Adams was in his presidency, Washington almost came very close to kind of throwing it all away, in that he almost undermined the presidency and messed with the civilian control of the military in a way that could have been quite dangerous had war actually occurred, had Adams not taken really important steps to mitigate the politicization of the army or pursued diplomacy. And I think in some ways, Washington kind of got lucky and died when he did, because at no other, like, when Washington was still alive, there were always going to be two presidents in the minds of the American people.
Right.
And that has never been the same situation since. And so once he died, he could kind of become this amazing memory and legacy, but not threaten presidents in the way that he did while he was still alive. And so I was sort of speaking to the dangers of that and the importance of a former president doing everything in their power to uphold the presidency for their successors. And I do think, at least thus far, I mean, who knows? We're just a few weeks into it. Time has no meaning.
So you say on that point, Lindsay, that Washington's death actually gave Adams the opportunity to avoid a threat between the army, the army basically threatening the presidency.
There were a couple things. I mean, one, the possibility of war with France was really diminishing, and that was largely because Adams quite rightly pursued a diplomacy when it was clear that it would work. But also, once Washington died, he could no longer be used as a political cudgel against Adams. He could no longer be used to boost people like Hamilton and his allies against Adams. And that was really essential.
Well, Washington, everything else aside, would you say that at any point they were allied, everybody knows the Washington Hamilton story, right? Everybody gets that, and what Washington saw in the young Hamilton and how all of that sort of came into play.
Yeah.
The point you just made about Washington, you know, once Washington died, it sort of took the sting of Hamilton using Washington as a cudgel against Adams. But was there any real alliance at any point between those two men exclusively?
There were moments
pretty much strangers throughout their relationship in that sense.
Well, there were moments early on in the war when they were, because Adams was so instrumental in ensuring that Washington was in charge of the army, and Washington knew it. And so they were very much aligned at that moment. Then I think very early on in the presidency, for just like maybe a couple weeks, when Washington was first in office, they were aligned. And then I think that that first transition, 1787, they were 100% aligned, and they understood that they had one shared goal, which was to do this thing, this really hard thing, really, really well. But then, to Washington's credit, once Adams sent the final diplomatic mission to France in the fall of 1799, Washington wrote him a letter and said, "I support this. This is a really good idea. This is the right thing to do, and I support you." And that, while Adams didn't make that letter public, it meant a great deal to him.
Ah, interesting. Interesting. So you have now, we have a situation where you one of expectations that I think John Adams had during his coming into his presidency, as we talked about a little bit before, about, you know, here's this great figure in Washington, and now you're going to succeed him. Are there any parallels that we can learn from as citizens looking at this through the lens of history, but also the expectations surrounding a potential Kamala Harris presidency, mm-hmm. As the first female president? That's some heavy stuff, folks. I don't care how you cut it. First black president, totally get it. Yeah, big deal, Obama. This, for me, feels different when it comes to that sense of expectation. When you consider this country still looks at women.
Yeah.
Just to put it in blunt terms.
Glass
ceiling. It is like,
yeah. So what was the first part of the question?
for those of you who are listening to this in your car, you should see, I'm going to describe the face Lindsay just gave in trying to, you know, posit that question in her head. It was more like, okay, what the hell am I going to do with this one? And where do I go? Because, I need something stronger in my water than water right now.
Yeah, this is not a water question. So first, in terms of what we can learn as citizens, you know, the lesson that I really took away from writing this book is that in moments of crises, we don't need military heroicism or incredible genius. We just need people to put the Constitution above their own partisan interests.
Ah, damn, there it is right there. Yep.
I know. And the people who often did so in this book that made such a huge difference are not necessarily even names we remember. I mean, of course, there are the ones that we do, the Hamiltons, the Adams, the Jeffersons, but they're congressmen that were in their 30s and 40s that were willing to make compromises for the good of the Constitution. And that really made all of the difference, which maybe sounds like a big ask, but I don't think it should be.
But you had the same question today. Think about those moments after, you know, the Mueller case and impeachment trials aside, but this insurrection on January 6th, which led to the second impeachment of President Trump, those members of Congress, particularly the U.S. Senate, that saw the evidence and did not stand in the breach on behalf of the Constitution and the American people, but took the selfish way out and said, "That's fine. That's okay." I mean, when you say that about those members of Congress who at various points in time had to put the country, this fledgling enterprise, ahead of their own personal political salvation or gain. That's a very compelling story or thread that seems to run throughout many moments in our history.
It does. And it has come up at crisis after crisis, and it has not been a partisan thing. It has been demonstrated to be a bipartisan act, which I define this as civic virtue, the willingness to put the Constitution above your own political goals. You know, the example that gets bandied about a lot right now is the Republicans' role in making Nixon resign. That was civic virtue. It was putting the Constitution above their own political party. I should also note that, you know, not that much, like not that many years later, Reagan came into office. So the party did just fine. So like, it doesn't have to be the, you know, forever end of political aspirations. But so it has been something that both parties have demonstrated. It is essential to the survival of the nation. It is the lesson that I would want people to take from this book. Transitioning that to Harris in terms of the expectations. I mean, I do think you're right. I think there is something unique because we see leadership in male terms. We code leadership
That's where I was
in male
going.
Terms.
That's exactly right.
And so,
I mean, to that point,
even,
you know how, just, I don't want to throw you off your point you're going to make, but it just real quick, saying that we see leadership in male terms, I can't tell you the number of people on my Twitter feed or who will send me text people inside the Republican Party, of which I'm still a member, much to their consternation. And they will say, you know, does she own any dresses? And I'm like, excuse me? Why does she always wear pants? And so I'm sitting there, I'm thinking.
Well, first of all, they tend to have pockets, which are really useful.
Which are really useful. Men figured that out a long time ago. That's
yeah,
how we have pockets.
It's really helpful.
And we've saddled women with these like straight things that they can't put stuff in. And,
also, other show business note, if you're going to have a microphone on you, having a jacket is really helpful because you need something to a lapel to clip it to. You need a pocket to hide the wire. So if you are going to be mic'd up, it's really nice to wear.
Women do not appreciate having men run wires up and down their back of their dresses or sometimes down.
And you often have to have it
stuff.
Taped. Do you know what it's like to have like tape on your chest? That's not fun. That's not fun.
But I just wanted to just give some context to why this, you know, this moment is bigger than I think we really fully appreciate, because we do continue to see the presidency, power, executive leadership and authority through a male lens, even though, Lindsay, we have female governors. Now, we don't have a lot of them, right? When you consider the 50 states. But it's interesting when it comes to the presidency, how we still view that through the lens of men, up to Obama, white men. But now he was a guy, so he's just falling into the male club.
And a lot of it is, there's been a lot of like sociology and psychology studies around this, which is it's like we're actually, humans are not very imaginative, and it is really hard for us to envision things that we have not already seen. So it is really hard for us to see a female president until we've actually seen it. And I would argue that that will have a trickle-down effect in so many other industries, so many other walks of life, that like once you see women in positions of authority, whether it's, you know, high powered positions, doctors or lawyers or whatever, you start to think that it's possible for women to be in positions of authority. And that's the most powerful job in the world. So does the highest glass ceiling. And there have been chinks. I do think that, you know, Hillary Clinton's campaign, while not ultimately successful, has made this potentially just a little bit easier, just a little bit. Tiny
and the irony is, for going back even, you know, to Shirley Chisholm, who was the first woman to run for the presidency, certainly African-American, who made the point that even with her loss in her bid, the idea of a woman being president would probably come through the vice presidency. As opposed to what Hillary did was a direct elect.
Yeah.
In other words, I'm just going to put my name out. I'm going to run like others before.
Yeah.
But in fact, that this country, to your point about seeing a woman in the role, would probably be a little bit more into that idea, having seen the woman as vice president first.
Yeah.
And I take note of that in response to how some of the Republicans are looking at Kamala's role as vice president as being less than, not successful, having done nothing, invisible. So they're trying to paint that, again, I wish y'all could see her face. They're painting this sort of trying to paint this covering on her that she was not there. She did nothing. They forget all the trips to Europe that she did during her three and a half years as vice president, seeding the ground and the earth, if you will, for Ukraine and our relationships with our allies in the battle with Russia. I mean, there are just a lot of things so that we can wipe that clean. She didn't exist. So yeah, we've never had a woman in an executive role.
I should also point out that I've done a fair amount of study of the office of the vice presidency in general. And with the exception of Dick Cheney, who people felt like was way too visible as vice president for a lot of reasons, most vice presidents are invisible because per the Constitution, they don't actually have constitutional responsibilities other than having a pulse. And so, and counting, you know, tie-breaking votes on occasion, which actually Harris has done a number of.
Right.
I think she's set the record
for the most.
But so it depends on the relationship. So, of course, the relationship is where actually the work gets done because the president determines like where they can be most useful. But this is a very common trope. Every single time a vice president runs, people say, oh, what were they doing? Where were they for the last several years? So historically, this is quite consistent. But it does take on a very interesting dynamic, which you're pointing out, that it's an attempt to make her not seem like an executive as opposed to just that. You know, she doesn't have any experience or something like that.
Let's say she wins. Beyond some obvious things, when you're looking at that legacy of a John Adams presidency, what expectations do you see coming to bear? I think it's fraught with all kinds of crazy expectations, not warranted in any point in history. Would you have seen some of the things I think people will place on her? But there are some other aspects of her presidency that, in reading your book, in some respects may mirror John Adams.
Well, I think the parallel is that, you know, Adams was fighting against the impossible standard of Washington, and which, you know, had a very corporal form. Harris will be fighting against the impossible standards of firstness, which is equally as impossible and sometimes is more impossible because it doesn't actually have a tangible form.
And
it's going to be one of those things where the first female president is going to have, people are going to have a lot of different views about that. There's not going to be one expectation. There's not going to be one model that you're trying to follow. It's going to be however many millions of Americans we have, that's going to be the number of different types of expectations for what it means to be the first woman president. And so I think that in some ways it's almost more difficult because she's not going to even know the expectations she's up against until she fails to meet them. She will inevitably fail to meet them because every president fails to meet a lot of expectations. Like, that is the nature of the presidency, that it is at this point, basically an impossible job, and is never more so than for someone like Obama or potentially Harris, who are in the role for the first time. And so, and she will, I have no doubt she will know that not only is she trying to be a good president for the nation and to help it through some very difficult challenges, but also whatever she does will be held against all women that come after her, which... Wow. Man, I don't want that job. I do not envy her that position. No, thank you.
I know. I see your point, and I second it. She's going to have very much, I think, like Adams, the opportunity to make something of the presidency that is different from the one who came. In this case, the ones who came before her. Adams had the task of making the presidency different from the one, Washington, who came before him. And in that effort, put in place precedents in the case of Adams, those norms, those processes that would lay as a foundation for how the country would move forward, establish a precedent for a transition of power, for a president having more control over who is in or not in his, or potentially now her, cabinet. And she will likely do some of the same. But also,
I love this.
Different.
This is such a more positive outlook that, like, I love this. I'm stealing this because this is actually super positive that, like, her firstness is, like, super sort of subversive in a very fun way and can be used to create a lot of possibilities. And I love that. And I'm stealing it.
That's, we'll end it there. We'll just leave it there. I've so enjoyed, well, the first time we met was doing, some work together for the University of District of Columbia and Sharon Pratt, Mayor Pratt, and the, you know, the Institute of Politics and Policy, history at the University of the District of Columbia. And I just connected with you, and I'm so glad I could come back now that you've done the book, and we could talk about making the presidency, John Adams, and the precedents that forged the Republic. It's out now, folks. Grab a copy. Make sure you sit back with a nice drink. Quiet.
Maybe not water.
Maybe not water. Maybe not water. I don't, the water thing, not when I'm having fun. But no, I love it. Dr. Lindsay Chervinsky, thank you so much for coming on
the
Michael Steele
Podcast. Thank you for having me. This was so fun.
Oh, it was. It really was. I knew it would be. She is a presidential historian and executive director of the George Washington Presidential Library at Mount Vernon, where you will find her. Please take a moment and read the book. Lindsay's going to be at Politics and Prose on Sunday, the 8th of September. And that's with my buddy, Peter Baker. You can follow her on Twitter, X, whatever the hell Elon's calling it these days, at LM Chervinsky. That's Chervinsky. That's Chervinsky. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank all of you for taking time to be a part of this great conversation, connecting dots. You know, our history is a nice foundation for our present, and it informs how we move forward. And this new book does it. Note that this podcast is part of the Bulwark Network. I'm so proud to be a part of that family. So thank you there. And you can follow them on social media at Bulwark Online. You can follow me at Michael Steele, and certainly follow the podcast at Steele_podcast. Until next time, everybody, fall is about to come. Ah, see, I thought I didn't know there's a changing going on outside. See, summer's over. I got the tan to perfection this summer, so we're good, you know. Until next time, y'all be safe, be well, God bless, and don't do anything stupid, okay? Because I will call you out.